The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Come back to Toronto from Winnipeg, you idiot!
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and we are getting wild in Winnipeg with one of the hottest wrestlers in the business right now and one of the greatest talkers of all time, and me, all from Winnipeg. I'm talking about Kenny Omega. First of all, just headlined the Tokyo Dome in Japan as part of the main event of New Japan's Wrestle Kingdom 11. They are calling it the greatest match of all time, some people. They're saying it's the first ever six-star match. This is the first ever seven-star podcast, all right? Omega versus Okada was a classic. If you haven't seen it, go find it on YouTube. And, of course, Don Callis, Cyrus from Killing the Town, also on the Jericho Network. He's a blowhard. He's top talent. He's over. He's from Overwood. I know that you guys are going to love this conversation. If you haven't subscribed to Killing the Town with Cyrus and Storm, Lance Storm, my old partner in crime, you guys got to know it's the one to listen to on the Jericho Network. Anyways, I was over in Winnipeg during the holidays. We got wild in Winnipeg. Don and I met up with Kenny Omega at a fine hotel boardroom there. We're going to give all the props later on in the show to all the people that made this happen. It's a great conversation that you're going to hear. The three of us, all from Winnipeg, talking wrestling. Kenny's talking about his character and transition from cruiserweight to heavyweight to Tokyo Dome headliner at New Japan. You hear how he got started in wrestling. Tough decision he made to leave WWE Developmental to pursue his own pro wrestling path. He's got a great story and tons of great wrestling stories, not to mention the fact it's a little bit controversial right now where he's going to end up. This show was taped before the Tokyo Dome show, before his controversial texts and tweets that he's been sending out, the texts and tweets that John Cena has been sending out. No one really knows for sure what Kenny Omega's future is. What I do know for sure is your future. You're going to be entertained by Kenny Omega and Cyrus. We're getting wild in Winnipeg here on Talk is Jericho. So make sure you check it out. Make sure you never miss any of the amazing guests and stories on Talk is Jericho. You should sign up for the automated email alerts to prevent that from happening at podcastone.com/Jericho. You'll always be in the know and you'll never miss an episode. Sign up now at podcastone.com/Jericho. Get all the 411 on upcoming Talk is Jericho shows. And in addition to the great sponsors of this show, once again, like I said, I got to give a shout out to Joe Sacco at Canad Inns for allowing us to record Wild in Winnipeg at his fine establishment. Literally could not have done this interview without him. So thank you, Joe Sacco at Canad Inns. Thanks to Don Callis, Cyrus for setting it all up. And thanks to Kenny Omega for being here. It's wild in Winnipeg here on Talk is Jericho.
I'm from Winnipeg, you idiot.
These are all on. Everybody's on. We're officially on the air. And this is something I wanted to do because I've been wanting to talk to Kenny Omega for a while, even more so when I found out that he's from Winnipeg. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to get the three, probably, let's give ourselves a pat on the back, probably the three biggest stars in pro wrestling from Winnipeg, with the exception of the late, great Roddy Piper. And we'll talk about if he actually was from Winnipeg or not.
Not throwing Bob Brown into this.
Well, yeah, he was from Kansas City, though. Or was he from, he was from Winnipeg, wasn't he? Right, so we got Don Callis, who's now the bell of the podcast ball now. Everyone loves him, everyone hates him, whatever. But this is a pretty cool a combination of like three generations of Winnipeg wrestlers that have been around the world.
I was at three generations. I'm like 2 years older.
Well, but you're still older. Jeez, I think you're actually in your are you 50 now?
I'm not 50.
Okay.
Lance is 50.
That's three generations.
Act 60.
But you were in the WWE in the 90s is what I mean.
Correct.
And I was there in the 2000s up till now.
Oh, I see where
Kenny's
going
just this. Coming on the scene.
That's
like three separate eras, I guess you'd say,
I'm
right?
Happy with that comparison.
Right. So Kenny, so you are back now because you're doing huge business in Japan. You're about ready to headline the Tokyo Dome, which for people that don't quite get it, for a gaijin, a foreigner, is huge. That's huge to say that you were able to do that.
Yeah, it just doesn't really happen. And I'm thrust into this very unique situation of being the main event of the Tokyo Dome. I know it has happened before. I think the last guy to do it was Brock Lesnar, and by no means shape, way, form, or fashion would I compare myself to someone like that. But for someone of my style and my stature to do that, it's really, it just doesn't happen. So I'm just kind of staying faithful to what brought me to the dance, so to speak, and I'm just going to go there and try my best.
But it's been a huge year for you because basically since AJ left New Japan, you kind of were put into that position of like the top foreign guy in the company.
Yeah, the company was it was in a scramble and in a state of disarray. We had two of our very top stars, Shinsuke Nakamura and AJ, just suddenly up and leave the company. And, you know, no hard feelings. Everyone understood the opportunity that was before them. But the company didn't know what to do with themselves. And they had no plan because in the matter of a day, the transition period between the Tokyo Dome, the 4th, and then the 5th, which was the day to start the next year's storylines, they didn't know what they were going to do. Mm-hmm. So they just said, okay, Kenny, you know, AJ was the leader of the Bullet Club. You are in the Bullet Club. Well, figure it out. You know what I mean? And there you go. So myself and the Young Bucks, I believe you've had the Young Bucks on the show. Yeah, they love you.
I met them in the studio for the first time as we were about to talk. Same as today.
Yeah, so me and the Young Bucks, we got together and we said, okay, you know, this is a chance to really show what we're all about and change something. And then thus was me turning on AJ and creating the Elite and sort of putting a different spin on what the Bullet Club was up to that point.
What I like about this too, and it's interesting, and Don, you might agree with me on this, is it's cool to see in this day and age that you can be a guy like Kenny or the Young Bucks and make a great living and make a great impact and not even have to worry about being in the States at all at this point in time. It wasn't like that just a few years ago.
No, I think, and that's one of the things we talked about on Killing the Town, is if I were giving advice to a young guy who maybe had an option to go into developmental at, say, 25, I would probably say, you know what, take 2 years, work in Japan if you can, work in the UK, work some of these big independents, develop a style that's going to differentiate you. Because I think one of the challenges when you have one system, everyone hits the ropes the same, everyone starts to look the same. And from a character perspective, If you're learning on live TV how to be a certain character, that's probably not where you want to make those mistakes. Make the mistakes when you're out doing the indies.
Sure.
And you come up. Like, I look at Kenny and I go, when he was 19 years old, he was a very different character than his current character. Mm-hmm. But that's a process of the journey, I suspect. Mm.
But you also said too that what's the connection between you and Kenny and his family?
So and I actually never knew this until so Kenny's uncle, Larry, was the Golden Sheik, who was a manager for Tony Candelo, and was a guy who had like natural heat. He's a great manager. And he was like the first guy to kind of take me under his wing when I was young and really crappy. He was my manager, and we were like a heel tandem. I never knew that there was the connection, I think, until Kenny called me to say a few words at the funeral. Mm. And I was like, the Sheik never told me.
Wow.
Okay, I've got a nephew in the wrestling business. And he and I would interact on, if I had a show, it was like he was, even when he was 19, he was one of maybe two guys locally I would use. But he never told me, the Sheik never told me, so I never knew. Because I probably would have taken a much greater interest to kind of go like, well, pass on whatever I can because the Sheik helped me.
And that's what we're talking about, the fact that you're from Winnipeg, Ken. I had no idea until maybe about a year ago. I think Owens and Sammy told me, because I said, well, what's up with that Kenny Omega guy? He's doing pretty good. He's like, yeah, you know, he's a good guy and he's a little bit quirky. He's a little bit weird. And I go, where's he from? He's like, Winnipeg. I'm like, well, first of all, that's why he's quirky and weird.
Yeah,
he's from Winnipeg.
That makes sense.
Second of all, what? So you grew up in Winnipeg and your uncle's a wrestler. Did that kind of influence you and want to get into the biz?
I had no idea my uncle was a wrestler until very late into his, well, he had long since retired. I had already started wrestling, and it wasn't until actually some of Don's trainees had told me, hey, yeah, we got this guy showing up at our training every now and then. He goes, apparently he was somebody saying that he was a golden sheik. He offers some good advice. He's just a real nice guy, and he's just there to hang out. And from there on in, I had learned a little bit about my uncle's past, had seen some of his tapes. After the funeral, people had told stories about how he would come in secrecy to watch my local stuff. So I didn't even know he was supporting me from behind the scenes.
Really?
Yeah. It's just, I guess we have a little bit of a, in our family, a little bit of a wrestling background. And
Did you start in Winnipeg the same way that Don and I did with Candelo and all that sort of stuff?
I did a lot of shows for Candelo. I did the Northern tours. I did some of his TV, stuff that Don had booked, actually. But I started actually originally with a company called RCW for Wayne Stanton.
River City Wrestling?
River City Wrestling. Yeah. That went out of business briefly. And then I started, restarted my training with TRCW. And that was under Bobby J.
Bobby J was your trainer?
No, he was not my trainer. My trainer, quote unquote, was Vance Nevada, but he wasn't as hands on. I pretty much just had a key in an empty building to train in. So
just go in by yourself?
Yeah, I could go in by myself, but there was a couple dudes, local guys, Mentolo and the Big O, actually, someone that Don had used locally, and they helped me out. And
so, what did you think, Don, when you were promoting at this point in time? Because I'm just assuming this is probably 10 years ago or so.
Longer. 15? Yeah, we're talking 14.
Yep. So you were still promoting in Winnipeg?
I was promoting Winnipeg with Tony and Joe, and then I was promoting Thunder Bay, was actually my big town.
So what did you think when you said, what was your name, Kenny Omega at the time?
It was, yeah. Okay. I mean, I used Kenny Omega since backyarding with my friends. Yeah.
And I think like he would have been like 18 or 19 at the time. So he literally was a kid.
Yeah.
And I did not have a habit of booking local guys. What I noticed, and I was telling him earlier, was the first time I saw him in the ring, I looked at Tony, I said, he moves like Muda. Because the way he moved in the ring, even back then, it was just different. Mm-hmm. Not to compare him to Muda at 19, but you know how Muda had that different way of that frenetic.
Yeah.
And he had that. And you could tell he was athletic because he was very light on his feet. And so I was like, I'm going to book that guy. And I don't, you know, I booked him as you would book a 19-year-old guy without a lot of experience. I put him in a tag match. He did some really great spots even back then. And, you know, he was a 19-year-old guy with a lot of ability. And, you know, you see kind of the result of it.
What did you think of Don Callis when you first met him? Because I didn't like him.
I was like a god, I think.
You know, if I'm going to be honest, I'd watched a lot of IWA TV. We had.
Did you really?
Yeah. So I'd seen stuff with you, you know, matches that you had with Ultimo Dragon.
Right.
And they played every second week your match with Rick. The cage match.
Martel?
Rick Martel. Yeah. And I think that's the one where Lance Storm does a crossbody off the top, right?
Off a very rickety cage.
Yes. Yeah. What an athlete.
What an athlete. Yeah. If you were only 5'8 instead of 5'7, you could be an athlete.
Yeah, Lance thought that like Kenny's Lance five. Lance told Don that Kenny was 5'7. He's got to be close to 6'1.
So,
so you watched the IWA
right
TV,
so even before I had, you know, the Winnipeg bias, you know, like, oh, he's one of our hometown guys, I love Don Callis, that wasn't it. I just thought that Don was legitimately a great wrestler. And without even knowing really what psychology was, how to implement it or how it affects a match, I knew that there was special things about Don's matches. Like, how could a guy that isn't really doing the athletic stuff that I love to watch and do, how am I still emotionally invested in these matches? And, you know, that's really the glory of psychology, when you can get it right. And Don could always get it right.
No bumps, I think, was. I think I had that on the back of my tights. No bumps.
No bumps. Did you ever put that on the back of your tights?
No.
You should have.
I might.
So, but when you were starting doing all these kind of indies, because like you just mentioned before we started talking on how you basically went from indies to Japan.
Because,
like, once again, I'd never heard the name until I started reading about you in Japan.
Yeah. So I had done a little bit of indies, and then the way that it had worked locally was that, you know, it was IWA, right?
And then it was, and then became No Holds Barred.
NHB.
NHB.
Right. So what you guys were doing, your production was our WWE. We were always aspiring to be part of those shows. So that was sort of the first big step for me. Once that had disappeared, you know, we had to think about, okay, wait a minute, you know, our WWE, quote unquote, is now gone. We have to think outside of these borders, or, you know, we just have to accept that we're doing this as a hobby. We have to grow as performers. So I started to think about taking trips outside of Winnipeg, and there was an NWA convention that was held in Winnipeg. They had brought in a bunch of outside talent. I had wrestled Petey Williams, who was the NWA X Division champion at the time. And the match went well. And I think for me, that was a great confidence boost. And I thought, I can actually have good matches and perform at a pace that is beyond Winnipeg now. So I should think about maybe just trying, you know? So I had went to a camp with Harley Race. He does a camp once a year,
right,
at WLW in Eldon, Missouri. And the winners of this camp, it was treated like a competition. They would go to Pro Wrestling NOAH and be inserted into their dojo system, because going to Japan was like the end goal, is what I really wanted to do.
And why is that? Were you a fan of all that?
I was, yeah. For the longest time, ECW is like the place where I just really wanted to go. I fell in love with, you know, watching highly athletic and sort of not rated R, but, you know, PG,
sure,
PG-14 style wrestling. I mean, I was a teenager, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to like this hard edge type stuff. It was about at that time, because ECW used a lot of guys that had experience all over the world.
Sure.
I mean,
they're their forte.
Right, yeah. So they were using guys like Taka. They were using guys like Jinsei Shinzaki and you know, Mike Awesome and who's an ECW guy, but Mike Awesome versus Masato Tanaka. They had that series there. And I fell in love with that type of style. And I also loved that all the guys that went from ECW to WWE had a certain kind of impact upon their arrival. And I just thought that was really cool. Like, they were known as, you know, the ECW guys invading WWE. And I'd thought that as cool as it would be to go directly to WWE or F at the time, whatever it was, it'd be great to have that kind of decorated resume and then coming into a situation where people knew who you were already.
Right, sure, sure.
Yeah. So, you know, I did a lot of studying, bought a lot of tapes from RF Video or whatever it was.
What a concept of tapes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's no YouTube back at that time.
Yeah, so I was buying like Matches of the Decade, you know, Volume 1, Matches of the Decade, Volume 2 and 3. So I would learn that way, who was good, who was bad, you know, what kind of guys I should be studying and what the landscape was out there. And I fell in love with Japan, and I already loved the culture and wanted to go there as a vacation spot anyway.
So when you went to the Harley Race camp, then
it was with that intention. Right. Yeah, like, this is going to be the big step one. You know, I'm going to have my dojo experience, kind of like how, you know, you had experience in Japan and Mexico and all of ECW before finally. You know, I wanted to be, it sort of felt like the right way.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
So did you go to NOAH first then?
No. What happened was, what happened was, as a surprise, Harley introduced the grand prize of this competition. And that was Johnny Ace coming out and saying that they're going to offer a WWE contract to the camp standout.
Really?
And yes. Yes. So, even though I was gunning for NOAH, I ended up being the guy to win this developmental contract with WWE. So for a year, and I believe it was 2005 to 6, or 6 to 7, I was in Deep South Wrestling.
You're kidding me. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I was employed by you guys at a certain point
in time. Was that Jody Hamilton was running that one?
Yes, that's the one.
Who else was there with you?
In terms of like the wrestlers, Miz was there. Right when I showed up, he was just there packaging him for TV, so he was only there for a little bit.
Yeah.
One of the Ascension guys, I think it's called the Ascension.
So there's a few guys. But
there was a few dudes, yeah. And there's some, you know, Sonny Siaki was there, a couple of guys that I keep in touch with now that are my friends are there. It's a good group of guys. Mm-hmm. They're all very nice. But the experience just kind of reinforced more what I had thought already, was that I really need to make something of myself outside of here before coming here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was a nobody, and I understood that I was a nobody and that these guys are going to treat me like a nobody and not trust me with anything, any of my own ideas. But I had felt that I could be this guy that could make this company millions and millions of dollars. But I just had to prove first that I could do that on my own, by my own accord.
Prove it to yourself.
Exactly. Am I just insane? Am I just this weird kid? You know what I mean?
Weird and quirky.
Yeah. Am I from Winnipeg? You know? So I decided to put in my notice and give it another shot in the Indies and see if I could get to Japan and work my way from the bottom up there.
It must have been kind of a tough decision to kind of walk away.
It was. I remember that the morale there was really low at one point in time, and Johnny Ace had said, "Hey, I've heard that a lot of guys don't like it here and they want to quit, and if that's the case, just come talk to me first and we'll have a chat."
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that I was, my morale, the day-to-day stuff wasn't good because the morale was low. Like, mm-hmm. it sucked to be around such negativity all of the time, but I didn't mind the training. I loved the physicality of the training, contrary to what other people might think. I loved doing a ton of push-ups and squats and running. That stuff is all fine by me. It was that I felt that there was no light at the end of the tunnel. Like, I was always just going to be this kid that was treated as a green piece of trash. And
right.
You know what I mean? And there's no way to grow from that. So I talked to Johnny and said, like, hey, look, I'm not going to lie. When you met me at the camp, I had really just wanted to go to Japan. And I do feel like I can make something of myself there. And I think I could be of more use to you if you understand that, first and foremost, you know, I'm a star coming from there. And I mean, even looking back at it now, some guy who's just a nobody telling you, like, hey, I can be a star here. What do you think? You know, why would you believe him? Mm-hmm. You know, but Johnny was cool about it. And he said, like, hey, I have contacts in all Japan. I'll let you know and see if I can send you out there. If that's really the path you want to take. I know that you're talented. I saw you in person. We can send you out there. And when you're ready, let me know, because the door is always open. Johnny was always super cool.
Well, Johnny would understand the benefits of working in Japan.
Definitely.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. So I felt like I was talking to the right guy to begin
with.
You
would understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Things fell through and I wasn't able to go to all Japan. He'd said that, okay, you have no name value and they just can't accommodate, you know, just some mark at this point in time. So good luck in your future endeavors. And that part was crushing, because I had thought I was going to segue from one thing to another.
Straight into another,
Yeah, exactly. But then it was that period where I had to feel, I guess I had to regain that hunger again. And so I just went back to I took a little bit of time away to think about what I was going to do next. And I just started plugging away again. And here we are today, I guess.
But it's interesting, though, like you said, Don, about having the international experience and having like a little bit of a different outlook. But I think also, too, and you'll probably appreciate this because you did it as well, it gives you life experience when you travel around.
Yes.
Not just being in one place and going into a foreign country and trying to find something to eat at 2 a.m. or whatever it may be.
Well, I think, too, it's like, what gives you perspective. I mean, so I went, my first international trip was South Africa. I worked in front of people who thought this was a shoot and wanted to murder me. Mm-hmm. So as a result of that, when I was in ECW and I would be warned about crowds, it didn't bother me and I was able to push the line. So I'm like, well, I survived that. What are these people aren't going to shoot me. They may punch me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you, and all of those trips and all of those experiences shape you along the road. Mm-hmm. And I think what Kenny's describing that he did took a lot of balls to walk away and go do your own thing. Cause the easy thing to do would just be to stick there. Because you probably had a lot of people saying, like, what are you, crazy?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I feel that a lot of people too fall into this trap. Indie wrestlers, they just want to see WWE on the paycheck. They don't care if they're riding the pine. They don't care if they're spinning their wheels. Mm. They just want to be there. That's enough. I want to be contributing and I want to be making a difference. And that is why, even though I could have just done what I had been doing, been an enhancement guy on their developmental TV and collected a paycheck, I think after my 3-year term had been up, I don't think they would have re-signed me.
Yeah.
You know, what did I show? You know what I mean? What did I prove? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for a lot of guys that are at the Performance Center right now, they will unfortunately never show what they really have to offer because, you know, they just marked out to have the check. Mm-hmm. You know, they just wanted to be an employee for the company, which is fine. And that's a great end goal. But for me, I wanted to make a little bit of a lateral movement and come back to the issue when I showed what I was truly capable of.
Well, absolutely. And like I said, that doesn't last very long either. If you do show up for, you know, if you're working in developmental or NXT, just in the lower ends, when you get fired, it's hard to get back in.
Definitely.
To any type of position there. Cause mm-hmm. you know, that I think a lot of guys go there too quickly
as well.
I mean, I told Harry Smith that years ago when he said he wanted to quit and go back to Japan. It's like, why wouldn't you, man? You're like not even 30 years old. You're not doing anything here and you have a big potential and a big upside. Go back over there and see how it goes. And it was good that you did that too, Kenny. And I think something I wanted to bring up between the three of us as well. I think from growing up in Winnipeg, we do have a tougher mental and physical attitude. Because growing up here, it's not like it's the Wild West, but it's not easy to grow up in Winnipeg.
No.
You know what I mean? It does toughen you, I think.
Yeah. And just as a wrestler, we're not in the ideal geographical location. Mm-hmm. If I am looking to get work at, you know, insert name here, that's going to be an expensive flight. How am I going to prove that I'm worth that flight? I've got to be good.
Right.
So I have to make sure that I'm trained. I got to make sure that, you know, when I think of how I put my matches together, when I think about how I'm making this character, that it's going to get over with fans and that I'm giving them their money's worth and making the promoter money on top of that too. So I can't just be a guy that, okay, if I get in my car and drive half hour away, I'm working for the best indie in America or whatever, and that's good enough. Mm-hmm. I had to hold myself to a higher standard just to get work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it was the same for you as well.
It was a little bit easier for me because I had a dual citizenship. But it was the same though. I mean, yeah. I realized really early on that you're not going to make a big mark just being in Winnipeg. You have to get out and go other places. And once again, that life experience comes in very handy.
The hard thing too here was there really wasn't a support system. Like, so
how do you mean?
Well, so when Jerry Morrow and Gama and Bad News, well, really Jerry and Gama came here in 94, Jerry took me under his wing and he's like, I'm going to watch your matches. I'm going to tell you. He's very hard on me because Jerry's very tough, but there was no one here to do that. I mean, the Sheik was really cool to me, but the Sheik hadn't been booked anywhere.
Right. He doesn't know.
Tony was a promoter and he gave me good business advice, but there was no one giving you that wrestling advice. So it became very hard. And I, like both all of us, I quickly realized like, okay, as long as I'm getting these overseas trips, I'm going to stay wrestling. The minute that had stopped, because in 94, I said, I'm giving myself 2 years to get a tryout with Vince, and then if I don't, I'm out. The minute those trips had stopped, I would have stopped, because I'd already done everything here locally that you could do, TV, whatever. And it's like, you don't have that support system. So when I kind of moved on, I tried on a couple of occasions with a couple of guys to be that support system. But the weird thing was, and we were talking about this earlier in Winnipeg, guys would be like, no, I'm going to listen to Bobby J or, you know, Jabroni number two who trained me. And I'd be like, would you take your car to a mechanic who'd never been under the hood? Like, like nothing against some of these
guys.
It's the
truth.
They've never been anywhere. How can they tell you how to get there?
Yeah, exactly.
But guys here didn't want to listen. And so I just gave up and said, well, I'm not going to help guys because they're not listening.
I mean, that's why I moved to Calgary. I remember when I was first starting to wanting to train, my dad actually had a conversation with Candelo about training and kind of got a little bit of a F off.
Do you have any money on you right now?
Basically, yeah. And then we go to Calgary where, I mean, it was basically the same, but Calgary was Calgary. It had the vibe of being Calgary and Stampede Wrestling.
Doesn't have the vibe anymore since Winnipeg has beaten Calgary, but that's a whole other
thing. Yeah, but still, the place to go, right? To be there, you knew that you couldn't get that in Winnipeg, which is what we're basically all saying, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that is funny because you did have the Winnipeg versus Calgary debate on Killing the Town.
It wasn't much of a debate. It was a slaughter, wasn't it?
No, according to Lance, it's his fans that won it. I mean, the funny thing about
his
that
his fans was, being Kenny's.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, of course.
We're chatting about it, and I was like, he's like, was that a shoot? And I'm like, well, I put the tweet out just to twig Lance.
And it was basically just give a background on what it was. It was the same.
I was thinking one day, I'm like, okay, wait a minute. I was like, because someone had mentioned to Kenny to me, and I was like, okay, well, you got Kenny, you got Jericho, you got Piper, then you got me on the other end there. I'm like, that's a pretty good four guys who made it, right?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, well, who's from Calgary? Like, actually from Calgary? It's like, well, it's the Heart. So, like, Brett Owen, okay, yeah. I get it. Oh, I'm going to put out a tweet about this, you know, just to get a little attention. And Lance, like, I think, legit got hot.
Of course he did.
And he's, like, getting hot. So then we decide to make it a thing. And I said to Lance, I go, you know, I said, I know, you know, you just don't like the fact that Omega's a better athlete than you. That didn't go over well. That's when you lost 5 inches of height in his eyes.
Right, yeah.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
What is it that you did over the past year from going from basically a junior heavyweight guy
right.
to being the main event of the Tokyo Dome?
That's a great question. What I wanted to do was I wanted to kind of vault. I thought it was a good chance to vault the company more from being the King of Strong style, which is, you know, a highly it's a traditional Japanese wrestling style.
Sure.
And I wanted to make it more universally entertaining. By that I mean, you know, have a style that's easily understood not only by the live house fans, which is always important. You want to impress the fans that are there to enjoy the show, but we have a streaming service just like the network, and it's important to make sure that those viewers are having a good time too. So I tried to, I wouldn't say innovate. It's not an innovation, but just make my style a little more easily understood universally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I had any sort of mic time, I would make sure to make the most of it, make it entertaining, make it fun for people. I think it's
so
important.
So how do you do it? Because you're talking about mic time in Japan.
Right.
Where people kind of understand English, but not completely.
Yeah. I was lucky because the people understand from my time on the indies that I do speak Japanese.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
How did you learn to speak Japanese?
Oh, I had a friend in you know, from the indies when I was in Japan, and he had went to college in America, so he was bilingual perfectly. And I had really wanted to know Japanese. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand how to speak it. I thought it would help my career.
Sure.
But I mean, it's easy to say that, but not so easy to do. So I would write little, you know, go-to phrases. And mm-hmm. I would say, could you please translate this for me? And I would memorize it. And then, could you translate this for me? And I'd memorize it. And I would have these little cheat notes in my cell phone. And eventually I had amassed so many of these notes that I was able to pick apart the grammar and the words, and I was able to structure my own sentences based off of that. Mm. So once I built up my own vocabulary, I could speak kind of a very simplified version of Japanese, and then I built upon that and upon that.
See, that's great, because I tried to learn how to speak Japanese too, but I found that like there was different types of Japanese depending mm-hmm. on part of the country you're in. You know, Sapporo is different from, you know, Osaka,
different from
Fukuoka.
Yeah.
And so and there's nothing worse when you're trying to learn a language, when you try and speak it and people just look at you and have no idea what you're saying.
Yeah.
That kills your confidence pretty quickly.
Definitely. Especially if it's just a small little nuance at the end, added at the end of a sentence or whatever, and it changes the entire way you're perceiving.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's,
you know,
difficult.
And it's like I remember going into a restaurant where they have the little rubber versions of all the foods.
Yeah.
You want, and I said, you know, hot cake or something, a hot cake. And
yeah,
they're like,
pancakes,
what?
Yeah.
Hot cake. And they're like, what? I'm like, these freaking things right there. I'm like, oh, hot cakey. I'm like, if I'm saying hot cake.
Yeah.
And it's hot cakey, like, come on, work with me here, man.
Yeah.
But it's hard. So I learned how to read it.
Yes. Oh, wow.
I learned how to read katakana. Oh,
That's very impressive. And usually people learn how to speak it before learning how to read it. So,
and I was backwards. I wanted to at least have some sort of form of communication.
Yeah.
So, Don, did you ever learn any Japanese?
Just enough to get my face slapped, kid. I went to Japan with Mike Lazansky, so we had some bar phrases down.
He was great. He tried to teach me Spanish when I went to Mexico with him. And he was like, he's like, si hilo means without ice. So I'd go ask for water, see Elo, and they look at me, see Elo. I found out later on when I learned how to speak Spanish, it's sin hielo, like agua sin hielo, por favor, but not see Elo, Mikey, you know, God bless him. So give me an example of a Japanese promo that you might cut on the fans, a quick couple seconds worth.
Go.
Yeah, cut a promo on Don right now and tell him you're going to beat him for the championship.
Tell me how great I am and all that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's tough when I get put in the spot, and I'm actually advised by my company to not speak Japanese at all as a heel guy right now.
Oh, they don't want you to speak
Japanese? No, they don't. That was part of the whole character, which is why I was saying like it adds to the mystique, I suppose, of Kenny Omega in New Japan, the guy that on the indies was speaking Japanese, and now suddenly he is not.
Oh, you refused.
Right, exactly. I refuse. I don't like the people. I don't like this country anymore. I'm focusing on my career.
Gotcha.
So I would kind of use that to my advantage in these promos, to use easy to understand English, but then I would sprinkle in a Japanese word here or there, mm-hmm. just to remind people that, yeah, I get your language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that dynamic, but then what I'm saying is easily understood by the viewers around the world. Mm-hmm. So, or I mean, not completely around the world, but I mean,
yeah,
you know, in the UK, Canada, America, yeah,
but,
a large portion of our
fans. Just give me one sentence of Japanese, like, hey, Chris, how you doing? What's going on? Or like, and like, just to hear the.
Oh, I mean, if I was just to ask how you are, I'd be like, you know, konnichiwa, Chris, you know, genki desu ka, kind of thing.
That's pretty easy.
Yeah, of course, everyone knows that. Yeah. You know, WWE, saikin dou desu ka, toka. You know, how has WWE been lately?
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
I like the fact that you could do that, because I'll tell you something else about Japanese fans. The fact, you know, on a shoot, the fact they know that you took the time to learn Japanese just ingratiates you with those people, and you'll have a job there for the rest of your life as a result, you know?
Yeah. It never feels like it's enough. You know, I always feel like I want to learn more.
Wow. So how is it living in Japan? I'm sure there's some cultural differences there.
Yeah, there's definitely... it's weird because I still feel like I'm a tourist when we're on tour because I'm in a busload of foreign wrestlers and I never have to speak Japanese. I'm speaking English with all these dudes, right? If the Young Bucks are there, I'm always with the Young Bucks. Like we're doing everything together. So if I'm speaking Japanese, it's only to help them order food or whatever. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
When you do like the talk show or something like that, do you go and speak pure Japanese?
Oh, yeah. Like we would do before. Yeah, that would have like we would do TV and stuff a lot, like variety TV, I guess they would call it, where, you know, they have a couple comedians and they're talking about some sort of topic that's in the news and they'll have various guests like, okay, this guy's a soccer player. Mm-hmm. This guy plays golf and here's a professional wrestler and he's from Canada. So, you know, I sort of have that, I guess the Jackie Chan effect, where you know that the language that I'm speaking isn't going to sound native, but, you know, the way I do speak it is, it can be understood and it's kind of cute.
Sure,
you know
sure. What I mean? Yeah. Look at the Canadian speaking Japanese.
Yeah,
right?
It's like we know what he's trying to say. He says, but, you know, it's not completely fluid. Of course it isn't. You
Some
know
of
I mean?
Those shows are pretty wacky, though, right?
Right.
Have you been on any of the ones?
I haven't done
wacky
an
shit?
Actual wacky one. I've been, you know, so I'm not going to be eating any live squids or like monkey balls or whatever.
I saw one time where these guys were, they're waiting, and there's a race, and there's a finish line. And at the finish line, there's a toilet. And basically, whoever can last the longest without going pee wins.
Right.
So they're just drinking all this water, and then they put them like in a like they're just standing there doing the pee pee dance.
Yeah,
and it's got the last 1 hour, 2 hours.
Yeah,
these guys just like they're just oversawing like, and you're watching it. It's like engrossing to see. It's like amazing to watch.
Yeah,
they're just so nuts over there, right?
I mean, some of those shows I would love to do. Like there was one, much like we were talking about. You're standing on a conveyor belt. And they send these walls at you at high speed with like a human body cutout in it, and you have to mimic the cutout. Otherwise, you're getting smoked by the wall.
Cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Things like that. I would love to do. And I'm not worried about being embarrassed. Like I love being embarrassed. I love doing fun things for the fans and fun things for myself. You know,
just
it helps
yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Entertained. Yeah.
Don, did you ever read any of those magazines over in Japan?
No, I was more into the live entertainment.
I remember
whatever do you mean, Don?
No digitization.
Yeah. The first night I went to Japan, Lance and I were there in 91. They took us to a Filipino drinking bar.
Oh, yeah.
Where
those
it's
are
like,
very famous.
Very famous. You go there, and as you know, you sit down, and the girls, they pour the drinks for you, and they give you food, and they treat you like you're, you know, like you're the big star. And like, you know, being a 19-year-old kid, talking about 19, over in Japan, like, all these girls are in love with me. Like, I'm going to bang all of them. This is great. And then, of course, you're waiting, and at the end of the night, they're all, of course, they're just all over you. And
they finally, don't go, Chris.
Don't go. You buy another beer. And I didn't know that you had to actually pay whiskey, too. So all the girls left, and I didn't take any of them home, and I got a bill, I think, for like $1,500 for the whiskey that I drank. I was making $600 a week, too.
I had the same deal when I was in Japan for Tokyo Pro. Me and Mike and Scorp and a couple other guys.
Scorpio, like Fly Scorpio?
Tukul Scorpio. Yeah. We're like walking. It is some small town, and we're walking down the street. We see these really pretty girls. So we like start following them, right? Like, hey, what? And they kind of go ahead, and they went down this alley. And then like there's a dead end. It's like, where the hell did they go? And there was just like
you're feeling around the brick.
Yeah, there's like a garbage door. It's like a garbage chute. We opened that, it was a door, and we walked in, and it was this like lavish club with all these Russian girls, right?
Oh, wow.
And so like, oh yeah. So they're like buying drinks, and then about 5 o'clock, all the Japanese business guys would come in, and they'd have their scotch and stuff that was already there. And this old Japanese guy sat down, he thought we were hilarious. He started, and he's, you know, we're all drinking, and the girls went. And then it's like Scorp goes, Don, look at the bill. And it was about $1,500, and which would have been my week. And I'm like, oh my God. But the Japanese guy, who this time is so hammered, it's unbelievable, just paid for everything.
Right.
Which
yeah.
was
Thankfully,
tremendous.
Yeah, that's like you said, they don't tell you that part of it.
Yeah.
Do you do a lot of stuff with sponsors and stuff, Kenny?
There's a lot of, you know, business like sponsor type meetings, which is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just pretty much doing a match and then being able to enjoy, you know, the greatest food that the town has to offer on the house. and those are always readily available. Like if you have, after every match, there's definitely somebody willing to take you out somewhere. And that's one of the greatest parts of being in Japan, is that you never really have to struggle to find someone that's willing to take care of you.
And then they go to give you money, or they go to shake your hand, say goodnight, and give you money for the taxi, and they put the money in your hand, and you leave, and you look, there's like, you know, 10,000 yen or 20,000 yen. The taxi's like, 200 yen.
Yeah.
I used to love that. I would always wait and see, what did I get today? But I mean, that's one thing I always loved about Japan. I still love going there. Mm. Even when we go with the WWE, is just the respect level I find.
Yes.
Not that people don't respect wrestling here, but it's a different level there. It's like a real superstar,
definitely,
high quality athlete sort of a thing.
Yeah. I feel like now things are a little different. I mean, like in the buildings, people respect wrestling a lot in America now.
Mm-hmm.
And wrestlers are treated more so like superstars and sports athletes. It's once you step out of those doors,
right,
you kind of become just like a normal Joe again,
right.
Which is fine. You know, I don't mind being a normal guy. I'm actually kind of a private person. I like keeping to myself. But, you know, in Japan, you'll never have any sort of problem finding someone that's willing to help you if you're in a jam or, for example, you know, wanting to go and get something to eat, get some AAA steak. Someone is willing to pay you for it.
Yeah.
I'm totally hanging out with you when I come to Japan.
Yeah.
Call the sponsors. I'm in town for a week.
Don, you could go dress up, do the Golden Sheik 2 gimmick, and you could be his manager.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Golden Sheik 2, the second.
But pay off.
Well, you're talking about you hang out lots with the Young Bucks.
Yes.
I've seen some of the crazy videos that you guys do and all that sort of stuff. And, yeah, you know, having Gallows and Anderson and Talk and Shop, which has now become a huge hit on Talk is Jericho, because they did it just to keep themselves, like we said earlier, keep themselves sane. Mm-hmm. What are some of the stuff that you and the Bucks do when you're together for 3 weeks at a time?
What we always try to brainstorm to give back to the fans. Like, we always feel like there's a little bit of a disconnect between what they're able to see on New Japan World and then, you know, what we're actually able to give them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, perhaps they can see some of our house shows, perhaps they can see some of our televised events, but those aren't always going to have English commentary. A lot of guys don't want to stay up till like 4 or 5 a.m. just to watch our 15-minute match. They can't do it. You know, maybe mm-hmm. they have families, maybe they have work or school or whatever. So we try to brainstorm these ideas to come up with these little videos and things that we do, sort of like mini documentaries on a week-to-week basis of what we do. That takes up a lot of our time because, you know, we're not good with technology, you know, but we don't know how to really edit these things quickly and effectively. We have no budget, you know what I mean? We can't buy crews of sound crews and special effects crews. We're doing it all ourselves.
Right.
So that's a huge thing for us is just, hey, let's just try something new for the sake of these videos that we're going to do. So, you know, today, you know, maybe let's try to find, you know, the Japanese hotshots that play basketball and we'll challenge them to 3-on-3. You know, we'll do stuff like that.
Sing Katy Perry songs?
Exactly, yeah. So let's sing karaoke. People want to hear us sing, maybe. And if they don't, you know, I mean, well, whatever. It's another reason to hate us, you know what I mean? Because a lot of people hate us too, and we like that.
Was it Fireworks you guys were singing? What song was it?
Teenage Dream.
That was a
yeah.
But that's cool that you have that. Like, we never had that in the 90s going to Japan, having, you know, Wi-Fi and cell phones and computers,
right,
and all stuff.
Yeah.
We'd have to watch the same old freaking movies on the bus every time. I must have seen Full Metal Jacket maybe 50 times.
Yeah.
You know? Or whenever Tiger Chung Lee came with us, Kim Duck, we'd have to watch his three movies, Red Heat, Golden Child, and some with Rutger Hauer. We had to watch it over and over and over again. But that was all you had, right?
Right.
You know, and now it's different now.
Yeah, even when I debuted in 2008 in Japan, we didn't have things like that. So I was riding like this little rickety bike. Eventually the pedal broke off and I had to pedal with one leg.
To get to the town?
No, to get to the internet cafe that was 45 minutes away. Yeah.
Sounds like a Tony tour.
Yeah.
So, here's right. this bicycle.
Yeah.
But that's so when you're talking about like over the years, you've been there since 2008, pretty much as a regular.
2008, I had one tour. That was my first sort of summertime tour. I was just meant to be a one and done. They were going to have me go up against their top guy and just whatever, pack me up, send me back on my way home. And
it was
an indie company. I mean, they didn't really have a lot of money. They couldn't keep flying this dude out from Winnipeg.
You're talking about from New Japan?
No, this is for a company called DDT.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you said you were going to New Japan.
No, New Japan has only been since 2014 for
gotcha.
Me.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, so I was actually with another company for a long period of time.
Yeah, because that was a low-level company, like mm-hmm. not quality-wise, but
right.
budget, like you said.
Right. Now, it is a very sort of special interest company. They're doing mm-hmm. a lot of really weird stuff. And, you know, they were running buildings that would maybe max out at like 200, 300 people. But they had one really good guy that really sparked my interest, which was Kota Ibushi, who for WWE fans may recognize the name from the CWC.
Sure. And he's the big top guy there right now.
He is. Yeah. He is the man. So I had went there to do a program with him for the summer. And even though that was supposed to be my only tour, the match that I had with him won Match of the Year honors.
Wow.
So
in one of the magazines, you mean?
Yes. And actually, it was for Samurai Television.
Okay.
So, Wow. Yeah. So that had won their Match of the Year award. And the company sort of felt handcuffed at that point. Like, when's Kenny going to be back? You know what I mean?
Right,
like, we don't know how to tell you. We had no plans of bringing him back. But okay, we'll bring him back. So they brought me back to do the rematch. And as much as I had wanted to do the rematch, Ibushi and I had thought that there was no way we could live up to that original match. Mm-hmm. So we came up with a way to spin that into us being a tag team instead. And us being a tag team ended up winning the next year's Match of the Year award when we won the belts. So from that point on, I had a little bit of job security. And I stayed with DDT, and we had grown and grown and grown as a company. And finally in the year 2014, I signed with New Japan.
Let's talk about one of my favorite things that I saw you do is with the match with the little girl.
Oh, yes.
You got to tell me about the story. Have you seen this match, Don?
I just saw the kick where you kicked her in the head.
Right. There's a little girl. And then did Ibushi do the blow-up doll?
We both had done the blow-up doll like probably 10 or 12 times.
Because that was unbelievable. So first tell us about the little girl, then tell us about the blow-up doll.
Right. Okay, so the little girl, that's an interesting scenario. We had, like I said, we were a small company. Mm-hmm. Eventually, we had grown as sort of the mainstays of the company to become this number 2-3 promotion in Japan. We were running Ryogoku Sumo Hall. And we eventually even ran Budokan, and Ibushi and I finally had that rematch in 2012 in front of a sold out Budokan.
Okay.
But yeah, we were running Ryogoku, and there's this promotion that had a lot of money backed behind it. And, they were using a lot of like shootboxing, kickboxing girls that were just getting into becoming like Joshi pro wrestlers. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, when they were scouting talent and recruiting talent, in their beginner's class, there was this little girl. And I believe she was 7 years old. And she was a huge wrestling fan. And she was really jealous and heartbroken that all these girls were getting scooped from the shootboxing academy to become pro wrestlers when she was the biggest fan of them all. Mm-hmm. So they felt bad and they wanted to find something for her. And so they had asked me, because I had done some mixed stuff before in Japan on the indies. And they had said, like, you know, Kenny's really good. He's safe. He's helped some of our developing talents become better. And maybe you could work with him for a couple weeks and see if we could get you to a point where you could do something in the ring. And so I'd said, yeah, sure. You know,
which is so Japan. Like, there's no way that would ever happen
no,
in the States.
No, probably
or, you know,
not, right?
A seven-year-old girl in the ring. Like,
yes,
no way would that
there
happen.
There is no way. And I did feel, I had my reservations about it. Because the last thing you would want is for this girl to get hurt. Mm-hmm. You just wouldn't want that to happen. And in wrestling,
stuff happens.
It exactly. Yeah. Even if you're as safe can be, sometimes
sure.
Just, yeah. Just by a
it's
series of events
of business,
unfolding.
Man.
Yes,
yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Exactly. So I had flown in early for my tour just so I could work with this girl. And I showed up to the training center and they had said, like, okay, we're going to show you what she knows. And they kind of ran through quickly what she could do in a ring already. So, I mean, she kind of sort of did, like, you know, the Rey Mysterio / Big Boss Man. You know, she'd hit the second rope instead of the top,
yeah, yeah,
of course. You know, so she could kind of lightly run the ropes. You know, she's seven, so she doesn't want to attack them, but she can kind of run the ropes. She can do like the lucha rolls and things like that. And they're kind of like, hey, we'll show you some of her kicks. So she's showing like me like standing combinations on the pads and stuff. And I said, okay, I can probably work with this. They says, but what are we working towards?
Right. What are we
and
doing?
They, yeah. And they had said, okay, well, on the day of your big show, we were hoping that you could do like an exhibition with her. And it felt like time was, it moved to a snail's pace because I saw this grand opportunity in front of me where I could show everyone something special, mm-hmm, and something, you know, real fun and funny. But at the same time, it's a huge risk because that's a permanent black eye in your career. It's possibly career suicide.
Yes.
If you hurt a girl,
right,
in front of a huge sold out Kraken Hall crowd. And then, you know, that goes online because, you know, how
course,
things
yeah.
work. On, yeah. And then I just become a laughing stock if I wasn't already. You know what I mean? But I thought the positives outweigh the negative and I was confident. So I said, okay, you know what? I can put something together. And so in that small little bit of time, you can't really start someone from scratch and then just teach them pro wrestling and say, okay, now that I've taught you pro wrestling, let's have a match. I trained her just what she needed to know for the match and treated and trained some of the fundamentals and things like selling, you know what I mean? How to sell certain things, how to react to certain things. You had really good sense about how to react to a fight and a fake fight. So we put together a safe match, things that would highlight what she could do, and me just stumbling around like a bumbling idiot, taking all of it. And I loved it. And for a year where I didn't really do revolutionary stuff, I was just kind of just being a top guy in DDT. That was, for me, in 2011, I think it was, that was like my favorite match of the year.
And it's a great piece of work. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. But she did the head scissors, and there's some stiff kicks in there.
Yeah.
And was there a finish to the match?
No, we did time limit draw.
Right.
It was like, yeah, it was. We just did a time limit draw, and yeah.
Did you have any problems? Like, did you stiffer at all? Or
zero. Zero problems at all.
Don would have stiffed her just for the point, for the sake of it.
Receipt. Yeah. She was probably stiff.
Of course I wanted her to be. Yeah. Yeah. Like
stiff as a 7-year-old.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
right.
Right. Yeah.
You told her to be stiff and then receded her for being stiff.
Yeah.
That's what I would have done.
Hey, kid. Welcome to the business, kid. Literally. So then tell us about the other one I love is the blow up doll.
Right. Now, okay. So we do have this inanimate object that actually has sort of a persona in DDT, and his name is Yoshihiko. And, just as a footnote, we also have an invisible wrestler as well in DDT.
What's that one's name?
Pretty much his if you were to translate his name, it'd be like Invisible Schwarzenegger. So
Disco probably booked that.
Yeah.
No, it was an alien.
Yeah, I was going to say, the invisible alien.
Invisible alien.
It is an alien with a cloaking device. But anyway.
Architecture degree.
So, people had worked with this doll before, and he wasn't overly used. And when he was used, he wasn't used in a competitive capacity. But Ibushi and I are really strange, and we just like having a fun time, and we like innovating when we can and where we can. So we decided, let's have a more competitive match with these. Like, we're regarded as top guys in this company. Let's, in this crazy world that is DDT, which right. is sort of a world that exists within itself, let's have a match where this guy takes us to the freaking limit. And it got so over that we ended up having to do this match over and over and over again. Yeah,
this is the epitome of, Flair can have a match with a broomstick. Well, Omega can have a match with a love doll, blow-up doll.
Because
if you watch this thing, you forget that it's a doll after a while.
I mean, yeah, if you're willing to enjoy the match for what it is, I really try to structure it in a way where, yes, this thing is defending, it's attacking, it has a chance of winning. And when we destroy it, you know, because there are times when I've ripped its head off and, you know, there's blood splattering everywhere and stuff like that.
Blood inside of it?
Yeah. That was my, yeah. we've done all different kinds of weird stuff because you can only do so much, right? So you always have to change it up and make it different next time. But we make people feel sorry for this thing and make it feel as though, you know, this is a human being putting its life on the line for the entertainment of the fans.
But it's a real art form. Like I said, like, I'm not just saying this because it's funny, because it is, but the art form of it, to literally have a match with an inanimate object and make people care for it. Like, it's really clever.
I understand how stupid it sounds. Like, if I try to tell anyone that hasn't seen it,
right,
you know, hey, I wrestled a doll, it's like, okay, you're a joke and you're an idiot. But it's not that we just decided, hey, let's just play with a doll and get paid for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We took a lot of time and an effort to come out with a way that this is going to look legitimate and a way that people would be sucked into this world where you could believe it.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, I mean, yeah. the more I go on about the subject, the crazier I'll sound. So we'll just leave it at that.
That was the doll was probably a better worker than half the guys you worked in Winnipeg in 1990.
Probably a better worker than Red Bastien Jr.
Oh, there you go.
He's going to come out of the woodwork and come after me. That was a El Pepe El Furpo or something? El Flippo?
El Flippo.
El Flippo, yeah. There's also a guy called the Tulip, by the way.
Oh, the Tulip made a comeback.
What?
He made a comeback, yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. Apparently
in Japan?
No. Okay, this is a story from what I understand. the Tulip right now is that he's a mailman. Or was a mailman, okay. or he is, whatever it was. And he delivered mail to someone's house who was a local wrestler. And he said, hey, wait a minute. I have seen you on IWA television, probably versus Don Callis. And I know that you're a wrestler. And what are you up to, man? How are you doing? And he's, you know, introduced himself as being a local wrestler. And, hey, maybe you should think about coming back. Next time he delivered mail to his house, he seemed interested. So he made a comeback to RCW that made a comeback locally. And
recently,
not recently, recently, this is going back like maybe 4 years already, okay. But, to see the Tulip again, after I kind of grew up watching the Tulip on IWA TV was kind of cool.
His gimmick was the world's worst wrestler. And he was too dumb to realize that the minute that he won a match, he was going to kill his gimmick. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to win so badly because he wanted to propose to his wife in the ring on Tony's TV right after the win. Tremendous. That's
I love
money.
Too that he had the classic fried blonde hair, which I believe the Golden Sheik had as well.
He did.
And I also remember I went and saw Don Callis, the Natural. You guys had a card down. I can't remember where it was, but I remember Como wrestled some Kamala thing that you guys had. And the Golden Sheik was there, and everyone was chanting Golden Shower at him. That was the big.
And they used to call him Welfare Sheik because his like his outfit was not luxurious at all. It was just like yellow spandex. But
Welfare Sheik. What? There were some good guys there. Who else did we got? Easy Rider. That was good. Gene Swan. That was Gene Swan in the cruiserweight turn.
Apparently was.
The Easy Rider still doing his thing in the city.
Is there still like? Do you keep an eye on the local scene going on in Winnipeg?
I do. And actually with every now and then, and I'll say like maybe once or twice a year, I'll make a brief appearance locally with one of Don's old trainees who is all since but retired. But, you know, we do kind of like a little bit of a comedy act. And
who's that?
Chris. I told you about.
Chris Stillwell.
Yeah.
What's his wrestling name?
Chris Stevens.
Chris Stevens.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I did not come up with that.
Yeah, he's right.
No, you came up with Chris Kotex actually because
I called him that.
No, you did. Okay. Yeah, because he's got a pale white complexion with red hair, so he looks like a tampon.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'm not.
And because he was always in a bad mood. That's what you said.
I don't think I came up with that at all.
Let's get into some Bruce Hart territory there. So we're getting ready for this Tokyo Dome match. So I got a couple of final questions. How did you switch your style? We mentioned like how you switched your promos and your personality, but going from a cruiserweight style, quote unquote, to heavyweight, which in Japan there is a difference. Did you change your style or did you just keep it the same?
There is sort of, the booking position of a cruiserweight is always going to be at a certain point in the card, and you're always going to get sort of a certain amount of time to do that match. I mean, that goes with any card anywhere on a wrestling show. Mm-hmm. And then there's also sort of this expected style of what cruiserweight wrestling is supposed to be. And the talent that you're working with is going to work their style. They're going to work the way they want to. So as much as I was trying to work a very different, controlled, and methodic pace as a cruiserweight, I wasn't able to do what I wanted to do until, like, literally right until I made the switch to heavyweight. I started to have less of just sort of like go matches and more matches with a story behind them. So it wasn't tough to really segue that style to becoming a heavyweight. It was just a matter of putting some weight back on my bones because I was dieting hard to kind of stay lighter.
But Japan, you have to have a little more beef when you're
exactly there. Yeah. So I'll never be a huge guy and like a huge guy and I'll always sort of be expected to be an athletic guy. So it's finding the balance of looking aesthetically bigger, but still being able to perform like an athlete. But the way the matches went, it was easy because the heavyweights were already kind of working correctly.
It's really changed now. I think you notice this too, Don, how even in WWE, if you're looking like Rollins or Ambrose or Sammy or Owens or the guys that are working on top, they still work like that's what I laugh about the CWC, the Cruiserweight Tournament, the Cruiserweight Classic. The heavyweight guys are doing almost as many, you know, cruiserweight type moves as the cruiserweights do.
Yeah.
So you notice that. The
so what really separates, where's the line of separation? It's tough to sometimes tell. And that's just, and even Don had mentioned this before, like guys just generally in the wrestling business are more athletic. So you don't have to be a cruiserweight to do a moonsault. You know what I mean?
Right.
There are heavyweights. There are guys like you that easily do moonsaults on a nightly basis and do them beautifully. So what separates the cruiserweight division now from being a heavyweight division? You know, what separates a guy from being too small to be heavyweight from being, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's deciding that line and creating that difference yourself, I think, in the way that you portray yourself in front of a live crowd. And that's the most important part.
When you're going to do the Tokyo Dome show, I'm sure you've done Tokyo Domes many, many times, but never in the main event. Mm. Do you structure the match a certain way? Are you a little bit intimidated about it? Or
no. I've always looked at the Tokyo Dome as like, this is our celebration. It's like a party. You know what I mean? Almost like a reward. We've worked hard all year, had matches. Yeah. All year at every, you know, sort of backwater town, great arenas, small arenas. We've had high stakes shows where we've had to go, you know, a half hour or more, where you had to perform. You had to have a match of the year caliber show or a match of the year caliber match. And then the Tokyo Dome is more like, this is New Japan. You know, mm-hmm. this is us. And,
it's
you know,
WrestleMania.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Exactly. For lack of a better term,
when you when you're talking about, what was I going to say? Don, ask him something.
So, you did a project with a guest or frequent guest of ours, Dr. Luther.
I did
Wrestling Retribution Project. So, there's a couple of things I was asked to ask you about. Mm-hmm. The first one, a little more serious. You did a moonsault where you shattered a $10,000 chandelier in the process,
right?
Which must just be a tremendous visual. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
All right. So, we were doing this Wrestling Revolution project. I can't remember what it was supposed to be called or what it ended up being called, but at some point in time, it was WRP, and it was kind of like fantasy booking come to life. Funded by some dude that I think used to work for Fox. He came up with a certain amount of money to pay a bunch of wrestlers, and he was able to make matches that he wanted to have in his fantasy booking league come true. So he rented out the Jim Henson studio in Hollywood, California. He gave us all different names, and we lived in this Jeff Katz universe, which is the name of this dude, for Wrestling Revolution Project. I was Scott Carpenter, I think.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Scott Carpenter was a...
What was the gimmick?
What do you think it was?
A carpenter?
Yes.
Well, aren't you the cleaner in Japan?
And then I went on to become the cleaner. So I'm a jack of all trades.
What are you, an 80s WWE guy?
Yeah. So Carl the Machine Gun Anderson was renamed as Killshot.
That's not bad.
He was in that too?
He was in that too. And in this match, they had said like, okay, this is the match. Like, this isn't going to be the main event match, or this is going to be the sort of like the workhorse tournament match, because this is all season one was supposed to be this tournament of who's going to be the Wrestling Revolution.
Well, the idea of the show was it was going to be a one, like a 13 episode,
yes,
beginning, middle, end, like a Breaking Bad or something.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
It was supposed to play out like a television drama, which is what I liked about the idea. Mm-hmm. But then seeing it all be filmed and seeing how many corners were cut and just seeing how poorly managed it was, I had quickly realized that, wait a minute, this guy just wants to sit in his throne and watch us wrestle. Mm. That's it. Which, I mean, he was paying us, so we did what we were paid to do. But on the second day, we had all thought, okay, this is never going to see the light of day. But anyways, onto the match. They want us to have this great match. And I thought, okay, for a little bit of flavor, I trust Carl. He's a fantastic worker. I trust that if I dive, he's going to give me a good catch. So I had this idea where I was going to do a reverse springboard and moonsault onto him. And I thought it'd be pretty cool. You know, I was a little younger. It was 2011. You know, things like that didn't scare me as much back then. So I thought I could do it and get away with it. Oh, and you know what? For the record, I went to the agents of the match beforehand. I went to Christopher Daniels, yeah, and I went to Lance as well, Lance Storm. And I had said, hey, you know, we didn't really get strict instruction of what you guys were expecting from this match. However, I had this idea where, you know, maybe I could do a dive where I do a reverse springboard on where, like, kind of like where the rampway area is, and then moonsault out. I said, what do you guys think of that? And Lance said, well, I think it's fantastic. Can you do it? Yeah. Okay, do it. And Christopher Daniels was like, I don't see a problem. Why are you even asking? Hey, that's all I need to know. So I go to do this moonsault. I typically don't do them very often because I don't really trust the catcher, but I trusted Carl Anderson. So I go to go do it, and I got way more hang time than I should have. My body launched itself into this crystal chandelier that just shattered as I was arced and doing the moonsault through it. So as I did it, it exploded.
Wow.
And there's like glass, like shimmering and glimmering glass, like raining down upon us. And it could have been very dangerous. I did cut my hand a little bit, but it could have been way worse.
Sure.
And it was just this insane visual of this beautiful sort of like Swarovski or whatever you call it. Like,
Swarovski
crystals breaking everywhere. And
did you land okay?
I landed fine. Yeah, yeah. He still caught me fantastically. We went on to have a great match, but the booker was... Jeff or the producer, whatever you want to call him, the money guy, he was very mad, and he had said, like, okay, this is going to cost me a lot of money, and you are now officially working the rest of this tour for free.
What Lance told me was he said Kenny asked me if he could do it because he was concerned about, there was some concern about being able to clear this thing. And Lance said, I thought he meant he was doing it into the ring. So I was like,
oh, that is
like,
true.
He's
that
like,
is
of
true.
Of course you're not going to hit that. You'll never
right.
hit that. But he thought he was going in, not out.
That, okay. That part is true.
Or
yeah,
Lance
sorry.
Do one but of the two.
Here's something else that's true that no one knows. Guess who the funding of that guy, the money man behind that show was?
What idiot funded that?
Me. No.
Yes. I thought it was a.
No.
Yeah.
That hit him up for the rest of your
Yeah. 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 The guy who, by the way,
So you possibly
it.
Have the footage of this then?
No,
the
that's
footage.
The thing. I never saw the footage. I never heard anything about it. You guys did this big taping with, like, I had no idea that you were involved and that Anderson was involved. Like,
yeah.
There was, I think Gallows was there.
He was.
Who were some of the other guys? Like,
so it was myself. It was Anderson. It was Gallows. Amazing Red. MVP. Chris Masters.
It's a pretty good crew of guys.
Yeah, they're all very good workers.
And the idea behind it was, like you said, it was going to be episode 1 through episode 12 and sold to Netflix and all this other
yes.
bullshit. And I actually thought it was a great idea. And I thought at that time it could have worked had, you know, it gone the way that it was explained to me and would have worked. But
the way
unfortunately,
that...
it didn't pan out the way, and I lost all the cash. I never saw 1 minute of footage.
I've got an idea for a wrestling company I'd like to pitch to you.
At least I know that yours would make TV.
That's an edit, Stacy. That's an edit.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
I'm from Winnipeg, you idiot.
What's your end game? Do you want to ever go back to the WWE again? Do you have any plans of that or any thoughts about that?
I once had this whole plan laid out of like where I was going to go, how I was going to end up. And now it's strangely changed from like this day-to-day plan. There was a time when I was in New Japan, especially when AJ was there, and I was sort of like delegated to being, you know, you're the cruiser guy,
mm-hmm.
AJ's our heavyweight guy. Mm-hmm. We know you can wrestle with the heavyweights. We all know that, but
you're the same size.
You know, exactly. He says, but you know, guess what? AJ's here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so AJ's going to be that guy. You're going to be that guy. So I was like, okay, completely fine. Like I think AJ is one of the greatest of all time. So I had no qualms about kind of being second banana to him, even though I wanted to be first banana, you know what I mean? Don't get me wrong. But I understood at that point in time that like, okay, I just want to do the best I can in that position. So my goal sort of became there. I want to be the best cruiser champion this place has had for a long time. And then when suddenly I showed up before the Tokyo Dome and they said, oh, guess what? AJ and Shinsuke are leaving. Oh, crap. This is a chance. Like, mm-hmm. What about my plan? Well, screw the plan. I want AJ's spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So then my plan changed from being, okay, I can be the Bullet Club leader. I can be a heavyweight now. This is crazy. And then they said, okay, we're thinking of maybe programming with Tanahashi and we're going to get you in the intercontinental title scene. Okay, well, I want to be the best intercontinental champion this company has seen. And I want to do a bunch of industry firsts. Not industry first, company firsts. Mm-hmm. So I suggested having the ladder match, a match that no one's
never
ever done.
Never in Japan.
Yeah, just it wouldn't
Did
do that.
Did that get over?
Yeah, oh yeah, it got over huge. Yeah. It was...
Yeah.
It was fantastic. And they said, like, we want to do it again at some point, which is great. I hope they don't overdo it. But mm-hmm. as long as they're open to doing it again and the fans were happy with it, I was really happy. We had the Intercontinental title run and it went really well. Lost the title, no big deal. And they're like, okay, great. Year over, I accomplished my goal. And they're like, okay, you're going to win the G1. And I didn't know that until, the day before. Mm-hmm. Like the day before the finals, mind you. So I was like, okay, well, this is huge. Like, this is kind of blown up into something that I never thought was even possible. I couldn't plan for this goal. Like, you can't plan. Like, I'm going to plan for the Booker to book me in something cool. You know what I mean? How do you do that? Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's really just day by day, and I'm just sort of being prepared for anything at this mm-hmm. point. And I just want to do things that the company hasn't done, and I really want to take the company outside of its comfort zone and do things they've never done before. And I sort of am a little outspoken in my interviews and stuff, and I've sort of booked my own angles a lot with this company. Mm-hmm. And I force their hand. Like, I'll say things like, if I win the title, I'm going to take the title and I'm going to book a New Japan show in America or whatever. And don't say that. We have no plans for this. You know what I mean? Or, I want to challenge this guy, and like, you're not going to wrestle this guy. Like, don't say that. But then I'll keep saying it. You know what I mean? And then they'll feel like they have to do it. And then whatever, I bring my A game and it turns out well. Sure. Yeah. I would never suggest to anyone to model their career after mine, because I've been in complete a-hole about it. And I've always put myself on the line, put my whole entire career on the line on a daily basis. I should have been fired a million times, but it was all for the greater good. And I was just lucky that when push came to shove, that it worked out in my benefit.
Sure, right. They must be terrified that WWE is going to steal you. The same with AJ in the club, right?
I think the fans are a little worried. The company is a little worried, but I do think that has helped in the trust factor. Mm-hmm. So when I come up with a wacky idea that may sound just crazy to them, like the ladder match, for example, something they would never do, they're at least open to hearing me out now, mm-hmm. because they're worried that if they say no, okay, he's gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah,
exactly. What's your favorite match you ever had? Is the one that stands out?
Oh, geez. I'm really sort of proud of the entire G1 that I had this year.
That's a grueling tournament.
Yeah, it was exactly, because it was a really grueling tournament from start to finish. I had sort of went into the tournament itself to sort of prove naysayers wrong. People had sort of painted me as this guy that was just a goofball, and I couldn't work a lick and yada 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 yada. I used that tournament to sort of vault myself into a situation to prove that these things that you wish that I was, that you want me to be, I can do all of these things that you think a good wrestler is supposed to do. It's just that I'm doing what I want to do. And I sort of spun that into doing it in a way that I thought was good for the tournament, good for me, didn't slight fans that liked what I had done leading up to the G1. And moving forward, gave them sort of a more clear idea of where Kenny Omega, the character, was going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is the character of Kenny Omega?
Yeah, right?
But you mentioned... But
tis the question.
But you get it. You're talking about character. So when you're in a New Japan ring, what exactly is it?
Okay, well, I guess to know where it was going, it would help to know where what it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
When I was given the Kenny Omega the Cleaner gimmick that I'm using now...
Meaning, what's the Cleaner?
Well, that's the thing. What is the Cleaner, right? It was meant... because of the Bullet Club, the bullets and guns, the Cleaner was supposed to be sort of like an assassin character.
Okay, gotcha.
The guy that cleans up the the murder site or whatever it is after there's a hit put out on someone. Yeah.
Like Winston Wolfe in Pulp Fiction?
Yes, yes, right. Yes. Exactly.
There you go.
So... the idea that they gave me, I was supposed to be like the dude from The Professional. They wanted me to be very silent, very cold. The way that I had pictured it, because New Japan takes a lot of influence from WWE, the way they book things, the way they model their characters. It sort of felt like they wanted me to be like Ringmaster Steve Austin.
Gotcha.
Where he had mouthpieces around him at all times, where he was more or less silent, and he was just a very calculated, cold individual. And I had always pictured myself, more like you, you know, where yes, I can wrestle, but I'm also, I can speak for myself, you know, I have this original style. I want to show to the world. I don't want to kind of just be a beat down, bruise you up kind of dude. And then have, you know, Carl Anderson cut all my promos for me.
Right.
I don't want to have to do that. And, you know, they had other ideas too. Like I was going to have fake tattoos on my fingers and stuff and show them to the camera. Like, and I can't remember what it was going to say, like clean up or, and it just, I just didn't feel it. So not as a way to act out, but I sort of took the literal term of the cleaner and I started bringing like janitorial items to the ring with me. So I took like garbage cans and brooms and mops. Yeah, exactly. We started using cold spray for whatever reason in our matches.
As a foreign object.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the cleaner gimmick became something entirely different. And I think that's when fans of that strong style, you know, the very serious, you're fighting the guy in the ring, New Japan style. That's where I sort of lost a lot of, you know, of those viewers. But I do understand that every fan is important. I want every fan to, if I can, to come out of a match or a show enjoying what they've watched. So I wanted to show to these guys, you know, I'm not disrespecting your company. I'm not disrespecting the business. I can wrestle. So slowly but surely, even though there's sort of like, you know, the me and Young Bucks partying, having fun, Kenny Omega, you know, I wanted to show that once there were serious matches, you know, once there are these singles encounters, that I could turn it up and give you guys, you know, Kenny Omega fighting for his life. Yeah. So it's sort of been a year-long evolution of the character and just showing people what it is that I am. And and I guess what Kenny Omega is, you know, even though the image is sort of what was given to me by New Japan and then tweaked by me, it's just me, Tyson Smith. You know what I mean?
Is that Tyson Smith?
Yeah, that's me. Yeah. So it's just a guy that likes to joke around when he doesn't have to be serious. And then when he has to be serious, he's really serious.
You know what I mean? Where did you get Kenny from?
Okay. Well, we were in high school and it was sort of like, hey, this is like when the NWO boom came about. So this is when, like, you know, Razor Ramon and Diesel would reveal that like their names were actually Scott Hall and Kevin Nash.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, oh, what? What? You know what I mean? Like, they're going to wrestle as their real names? Like, these guys all... Like,
it seems so
exactly
normal, but at the time it was unbelievable. Like Kevin Nash, that's not a wrestling name.
Exactly. So like, geez, like I know they're wrestling as themselves, but like, I guess I need a character name like that. And I actually remember that you said when you'd always thought my name was Kenny. And
because I said, why would you change your name?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
It's a great work name.
Yeah. That's what he said. Yeah.
Good mark.
And I was like, I don't know. But at the time when I was in school, I felt like I got to come up with something. So I wanted, I was set on using Omega. And I was like, what could I add to Omega? Not to sound like I was some kind of like, you know, supernatural being, but just like a normal dude. And I just thought that Kenny like flowed into the O, so it's like Kenny Yo Omega, you know what I mean? And that's it. That's all it was.
It. That's it.
Yeah, that's and it kind of stuck.
It's better than Timmy Omega.
Right. Yeah.
Last question. This is for all of us. Give me your top three local Winnipeg wrestlers.
Oh.
So I'm going to start. I'm going to go with Stan Saxon was one. I worked with him quite a bit. Kind of a normal looking guy, kind of a big guy, but nice haircut.
Great voice.
Yeah. Is he in radio now?
He's in radio.
Yep. No kidding. In Winnipeg?
No. Like, I think Grand Rapids or something. Yeah.
Shout out to Stan Saxon. Then there's the Lil Bulkster, who was a guy that Tony had. Do you remember this guy, Lil Bulkster?
I had to wrestle him, so yes, I remember him well. He was 5'2" and 250.
And Tony called him the Lil. L-I-L.
Yeah, Lil. Yeah.
Lil Bulkster.
Apostrophe, yeah.
Yeah. When I was in Red River Community College, shout out to them, I went and did a newspaper piece on the Lil Bulkster because I actually contacted Tony and asked if I could do a story on his promotion. He said, do a story on the Lil Bulkster. So I went and met up with the guy. He's about 5'2", giant power lifter. Didn't last very long, though. Don.
No, he was the shits. Absolutely horrifyingly bad.
There you go.
And when I would get in the ring with him, like I was like 6'2" or whatever, and this guy like legit was 5'2". It didn't matter at that point how big he was. It just looked ridiculous. And I would have him press slam me, and it was like taking a hip toss from Lance or something. It was like, that's how high you'd have to bump. He was terrible.
The other was Captain Jones.
Oh my God, the worst ever. Because you know what? Sailor gimmicks are money, kid. Yeah, oh, just keep that in mind.
What's that, Don?
Sailor gimmicks are money. Yeah. Try that in Japan.
They put him in a blue bodysuit. You know, they just look like a high school teacher.
Yeah, and a yachtsman.
A little yachtsman hat. And I actually
worked for Tugboat, you know?
I worked with him one of my first tapings here at the, whatever it was we used to work
He's
at, the
nice
Diamond
guy,
Club.
He's terrible.
What? Oh, awful. God. I remember one of those guys, you give him a dropkick, instead of taking a flat back bump, he looks like he fell off a skateboard. Like he jumps up in the air and then kind of falls down.
Yeah,
Like an old man bump. So, yeah, who you got?
Well, I guess I have to include Chris Kotex, and I'm still not saying that I'm still not saying I took credit for that. Ivan the Smashing Machine Szczynski, who was Krzysztof Szczynski, who became a UFC star of some note.
Yes,
I trained him to be a wrestler, which he wasn't great, and you probably were stiffed by him several times.
Oh, yeah, multiple times.
And then I sent him out to Bad News to learn some shoot, and he fell in love with UFC, so there you go.
Okay.
So people say I don't have a shoot background. I have a shoot
background. You have a shoot background,
And then probably the Gimp would be number one.
Gimp would be very high up
there.
Gimp
was money.
Yeah, definitely.
Career was all downhill after that, though.
Who was the Gimp?
He was a local guy.
I thought you were telling me that it was Kenny.
We're running Georgie's. No, your stomping grounds.
Yeah, Georgie's.
Running
Georgie's.
And I couldn't afford on what Georgie's was paying me to hire, like,
what were they paying you to do a show?
$2,000.
That's not bad.
So I said the guys could all make $20 because I wanted to pocket $1,800. That was my intellectual property. So anyway, all these local guys I'd never met showed up for the $20 payoff. And this guy shows up and he's like 6'4", skinny fat guy, zits on his back, pale, no, really though. He's in a lot better shape now. He's in a lot better shape now. But at that time, and he had this like kayfabe gimmick. I'm like, what is this? He's like, well, I cover myself up. So I, for some reason, had a pair of Speedos in my bag because I think I had them as undertights. And I'm like, put those on. They're like a 32 waist. He's like, well, these are way too small. I go, exactly. So he puts them on, and like, it was tremendous. And he's like, oh, I feel really stupid. And I'm like, dude, I go, no one's going to make fun of you being fat. And we put the zipper mask on him, the leather zipper mask. And he eventually became part of Lenny's crew when Lenny was a champion here, along with little person evil Brian and a sidekick named Lingula.
Yeah. I actually think you even called him Lingula number two. Like, it's like, as if he was one of the Villanos.
It's a family of Lingula.
Hio del Lingula.
Who you got, Kenny?
Lingula del Hio.
He was also known as the Pet Shop Boy, just by the way.
Right. Oh, man, like, your guys' lists are so good. And I was actually thinking, legitimately, who my favorite workers in the city are.
I'll give him a shout-out.
Well, I mean, I got to give him a little bit of credit because he helped train me, actually, when no one else would, when I was in an empty facility. He goes by Mentolo.
Mentolo.
Had a little bit of success in Mexico and Japan. Great guy. I wouldn't have had any sort of base to do anything in the city, and I wouldn't have been nearly good enough to be on your shows, Don, if it wasn't for him. So definitely gotta give him a shout.
And make that $20 at Georgie's.
He got me made more than that. He had to drive to Thunder Bay for it, though.
Yeah. Mike Angels, if you have watched any of my, I guess, more notable internet matches, there's a match where I'm wrestling in my cottage area, which is like the king of
Canadian word, by the way, cottage.
Yeah, cottage, cabin. I don't know. It's called the King of the Anywhere match. It was sort of my introduction video to getting to the Indies in Japan, and he was my opponent there, master of the stomach claw, fantastic worker, could have easily made something of himself, but he became a successful teacher. So
okay, there you go.
Yeah, good. Give it to Mike Angels, and you know, the referee of that match, I'll say it was Ross Skills with a Z, of course, because he was, you know, you gotta sound cool and funky that way. But all jokes aside, Ross Skills, you know, one of the guys that we would come to the bar.
Yeah.
Every week, and we would be there with Mentolo and Mike Angels, and we would just hammer out stuff that we'd seen on tapes because we had no trainer, so we had to watch it and then mimic what we had seen to actually get some sort of real live training in pro wrestling. So one of my past training buddies, some of the best matches I had in year one of my career, year one and two and three, I guess. Yeah. Those are the dudes.
And here you are, about ready to headline.
But I mean,
Tokyo Dome. It's a good mix of Winnipeggers here. We made a lot of money between the three of us. Top talent.
There you go, kid. I got a couple of blow-up dolls in the car if you need an extra one for me.
Yeah. Would you borrow them from Lance again?
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
Hey!
Yeah. Actually, I got
a 5'7 one for you.
Yeah. this doesn't have to be on air.
Oh, but, we got
it. Could be, oh, no. And I always wanted to know the connection, because now I'm jogging my memory. When he came up with the question of how did I come up with Kenny Omega, and I thought of it when I was at school. Actually, at that school, one of my teachers had said that he was your friend. And if that is true, we had sort of indirectly, or you have indirectly given me a gift. When I was in high school, I had received a Blind Guardian album from you.
What?
Yeah.
You like Blind Guardian?
I love Blind Guardian. I was in a huge power metal phase, and he's like, he'd seen that
who
I was wearing the t-shirt.
Name? Who was it?
I don't. I think it was Daniel. Daniel or David? Mr. Martins.
Yeah, Dan Martins.
Yeah, yeah, okay,
Dio.
There it is.
His nickname is Dio.
Yeah, there
Dan
you go.
Dan Martins.
Yeah.
So how did you get a Blind Guardian record from him?
He had seen that I was wearing a shirt, and he's like, hey, you like Blind Guardian? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, okay, I'll give you something tomorrow. So I showed up, and he gave me Imaginations from the Other Side.
That's right.
And he gives it to me, and he's like, well, geez, thanks, man, because I just bought my first album the other day and just became like an overnight fan. And I was like, well, thanks. He's like, well, don't thank me. Thank Jericho. And I was like,
go,
I was like, what? I was like, I thought he was just like ribbing me. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, haha, you dumb wrestling mark. Like, yeah, thank Stone Cold Steve Austin, you loser.
No,
you know
that's
what I mean?
True. That's
but
true.
Yeah, you guys are really friends.
Yeah,
so,
you are really friends. Yeah. I really did give him the Blind Guardian record. He gave it to you. So
yeah.
There you go. Indirectly. Here we
yes.
are 15 years later.
Regifted it.
Regifted it. I know. But
yeah.
15 years later.
Yeah. The
All
Indian
right.
giver, Dan Martins. Yeah.
Thanks to Kenny Omega and my special co-host Cyrus from Killing the Town. Had a great time talking wrestling, getting wild in Winnipeg. I'm sure we're going to see more great things from Kenny Omega no matter what he does or where he goes. Is he going to stay with New Japan? Is he going to go to WWE? I don't know. But we're going to find out very soon. And as for Cyrus, he and Lance Storm are also killing on Killing the Town. They had a great interview with Kenny Omega. If you listen to both, you know that I took the chandelier story from their interview and put it into mine because I thought it was so great. I wanted everybody to hear it. But more great insight with Kenny, Shane Douglas, Paul Lazenby did a live on-the-spot report of Kenny's match from the Tokyo Dome. That's on this week's Killing the Town. Go check it out. Very, very intelligent discussion. Also, great debate over where... If Japanese fans or North American fans, which ones are better. So go check that out. Great time with Kenny and Cyrus, wild in Winnipeg. Thanks again to Joe Sacco and Canada Inns on Pembina Highway there in Winnipeg for lending us the boardroom and helping us get this done. Great, great times. Love Winnipeg. Love Kenny. Love Cyrus. I love all of you. All right. You got to check out all the great shows that we got for you here on the Jericho Network, including Killing the Town. That's every Tuesday. Hit subscribe at iTunes and Stars. Go and hit the subscribe button for all the great Jericho Network podcasts, the flagship show, Keeping It 100 with Conan. New episodes every Thursday, Conan, Disco, and the gang. Never know who's going to show up, what they're going to talk about. Lots of laughs, lots of fun, lots of ball busting. Great, great pop culture laughs every Sunday morning with Team Tiger Awesome. Monday, Truly Engaged, do a great job bringing the humor to the Jericho Network. They're also looking for your help into what to call their fandom, and they're trying to predict what kind of a future are we heading towards. Is it going to be Terminator? Is it going to be Judge Dredd? Is it going to be Minority Report? Go check that out and tweet them at TT Awesome and help them decide which future are we heading for. Is it Total Recall? Is it Blade Runner? They are going to be discussing that. They are discussing it. They did discuss it, and they want to know your thoughts. And of course, our new paranormal show, Beyond the Darkness, is kicking ass and doing so good, terrifying everybody. It's doing so much scariness, so terrifying, so horrific, that we're going to move that show to 5 days a week. That's right, 5 days a week with Beyond the Darkness, Darkness Radio. The whole Darkness Radio franchise is coming to the Jericho Network. They already do 5 shows a week on their terrestrial radio. Well, that's done. We're bringing it all here to the Jericho Network. Beyond the Darkness, starting Monday, January 23rd, 5 days a week to scare the pants off you daily. Thanks for listening to all my great shows, and thanks to you, the Talk is Jericho fans, for supporting all my great sponsors and for doing all your shopping through the Talk is Jericho Amazon links. Easiest way to support the show. Remember, you can find my Amazon links at podcastone.com. Click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page. Hit the Talk is Jericho button. I got Amazon links for USA, UK, Canada A. Every time you use them Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover production costs. Buy anything you want. There's no extra fees or hidden charges. Just go to podcastone.com. Click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All right. You find all my other great sponsors there as well, including DDP Yoga. Get 25% off all DDPY merch and swag.
swag at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Don't forget about True Car. Don't forget about Geico. And don't forget about the biggest podcast ever. When Mick Foley joins Talk is Jericho, countdown rolls on, 59 days and counting. So excited about that, and so excited for you to hear the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And on Wednesday, a good friend of mine in the wrestling business, down on his luck, he's hitting some hard times. We're going to try and help him get him back on his feet. The extremely entertaining, very interesting, and about as straightforward as you can get, Perry Saturn is going to be here on Talk is Jericho. We're going to talk all about his highs, his lows. He's having some tough times right now. GoFundMe.com/Perry Saturn if you want to throw a couple bucks his way. He could use it. He's a good guy. He's a genuine guy. And I'm very excited to have him on Talk is Jericho. I think you're going to love it. Perry Saturn on Wednesday. Thank you so much. Have a safe weekend. Peace, love, and hugs. And a big yeah, boy.
How's it going, eh? Wild in Winnipeg. All right, man.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.